Kids separated from their parents at the border and brought to Florida. The state's attorney general heckled at a movie theater. And candidates for office across the Sunshine State jumping right into the fray. Just ahead, the lay of the land in our Florida politics. It's never boring, but it's a particularly tense moment in time now. We'll talk about it coming right up. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live on the radio at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, we're taking your calls as we talk politics in this state and in the nation as candidates in Florida qualify to run for office. Let us know your thoughts on the hottest races and issues everyone's talking about. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, First Coast Success profiles local legal legend, attorney Hank Cox. Plus, it's Culpepper later in the hour on the World Cup and the rest of the week's sports. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, in this extreme summer heat, lately it sometimes feels like Florida is wilting in the heat of our politics, careening from one crisis to another, with children who've been separated from their parents being held in immigrant detention centers in this state. Two angry, hostile political camps ramping up their rhetoric against each other, stoked by a president who over the weekend called for the suspension of due process by immigrants coming into the country illegally. As all of this plays out, it's important to note that candidates for office have been working behind the scenes for quite some time to get their ducks in a row. The primary election in Florida is coming up sooner than you think, at the end of August, and the 28 midterms are in November. Noon on Friday was the qualifying deadline for making the ballot for many of these candidates. So, from the governor and Senate races on down, what is the lay of the land in this tense political moment here in Florida? Here with their thoughts, we welcome A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Daniel Cronrath, who teaches political science at FSCJ. Good to see you.
Hi, Melissa.
And here's our question to callers. So much has happened over the last few days, it's hard to even know what question to ask everybody out there. But whether it comes to the situation at the border, Republicans and Democrats being harassed in public when they go out to eat, our local politics and our state races, the Senate race, the governor's race, we're going to be talking about it all now. So give us a call with your thoughts and just be part of our conversation at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online and send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets go to @MelissaInJax and weigh in as well on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. A.G. Gankarski, let's begin with you. We'll talk about the situation at the border, which Florida continues to play a role in a moment. But first, Friday was the qualifying deadline, and you've been following a number of candidates and races to see who would make the ballot and what the lay of the land will be moving ahead to the November elections. From the top of the ticket on down, Rick Scott, Bill Nelson, to the race for governor, and then local and state races, what are you following most closely? What has caught your eye?
I'll say this briefly. Obviously, I want to see if Bill Nelson can erode what looks to be a consistent Rick Scott lead in a general election poll, that's going to go through November. Looking at things on the August ballot, DeSantis-Putnam is going to be hot on the Republican side. I mean, Putnam's up 15 in polls, but that doesn't factor in the Trump factor. It doesn't factor in a $12 million ad buy for DeSantis. That's a big deal. Democratic side, you're seeing polls that are showing everybody pretty much up at this point, which says a lot about the polling. But, you know, can Gwen Graham actually consolidate the establishment lane and pull through like people thought a year ago? Looking at local races, a couple of primaries are catching my eye. House District 14, Kimberly Daniels, arguably the most iconoclastic Democrat in the legislature, facing a Democratic challenge. Paula Wright, school board chair. She's going to have a lot of establishment support. Kim Daniels will have Republican money coming in on the back end. That's going to help her. It's going to be interesting fundraising to watch. House District 15, tonight there's a forum with the three Republican candidates. Joseph Hogan, the son of Mike Hogan, the election supervisor. Wyman Duggan, a prominent city hall lobbyist. Mark Ziegler, a yacht broker. They're vying to face Tracy Polson, and Tracy Polson has money, has organizational backing, and is looking to take Jay Fant's seat in the House. Jay Fant, remember, resigned, running for Attorney General. Now he's in the mix for Office of Financial Regulation and Commissioner. Those are the races I'm watching. And, of course, Alvin Brown, Al Lawson on the Democratic side for the House.
Okay. Those are all races that we're going to keep talking about, but it's 549-2937 to join us. Daniel Cronrath, as all of the politicians jockey for position, this ongoing furor over the situation at the southern border has showed no signs of abating in this country and in this state, where we learned that a number of the kids that have been separated from their parents are being held at facilities in South Florida. Over the weekend, the president of the United States called for the suspension of due process, which is enshrined in the Constitution, for anyone who steps foot on this nation's soil, legally or illegally, and said that judges and court cases should be set aside and people should not have due process if they attempt to cross the border illegally. How is that playing out politically in this state, do you think, this closely divided state?
Well, I think it's interesting, Melissa. You know, you point out the situation over the weekend, and I think one of the things that struck me over the weekend, and just looking back at the last week with a lot of the president's comments and the situation at the border, is that typically, you know, we like to think of our president of the United States as being the first citizen of the United States, if you will, and being that individual who really embodies American values and is our primary and our first defender of the Constitution. In regards to the president's comments about suspending due process, the president using language in tweets, you know, referring to individuals who are coming here across our southern border as an infestation, using words like them and those to describe these individuals who are coming here. Some obviously illegal through border crossings, but in, you know, using the president's vernacular, he lumps people who are doing the very legal step of pursuing asylum in the United States as individuals who are being lumped in with this group. You know, it, for me, as somebody who's a political scientist, it's disturbing. It's not something that I quite frankly thought in my lifetime I would hear come out of a president of the United States. You know, regardless of what the president likes to reference with, some obviously there are some very, very bad people who do come over the border, who do seek and do crime in the United States. Clearly nobody's arguing that. But we know that the overwhelming majority of these people, Melissa, are people that our country has been accepting with open arms for the last 200 years. They're people who are looking here for a better life. How does that impact local policy, to answer your question? Adam Putnam is obviously up on the air with a lot of ads talking about his ability, if he's elected governor, to protect our border. Almost exclusively some of Adam's ads, Commissioner Putnam's ads, have reflected that. I think that, you know, this is going to be an issue. I think the other thing, too, that's going to be interesting, is especially in this August primary between DeSantis and Putnam, is what kind of the coattails does the president actually have? We know that the president has endorsed, as AG pointed out, Representative DeSantis. Will the president be able to come down here and actually have some coattails, or will it be a situation like we saw in the Connor Lamb race in Pennsylvania and the Alabama Senate race, where the president's magic really only applies to himself in terms of how these elections are going to shape out.
What about that, A.G. Gankarski? When the latest polling shows among Republican voters, President Trump has 90% approval.
Yeah, and that's including the amendments, you know, the changing to the constitutional policy regarding the border and everything else. The Republicans are standing by Trump no matter what. And that's the DeSantis' Trump card. You know, that's the thing that factors into play. You've got half the voter pool still undecided, according to these polls, between Putnam and DeSantis. You're going to see the Trump factor. You see Don Trump Jr. You're going to see Judge Jeanine, Sean Hannity, all of these Fox News personalities coming through for DeSantis. And that's going to be a lot of what his campaign is predicated on. You know, it's going to be something also where Putnam's painted as a never Trump type, because Putnam was late in the game in 2016 in backing Trump. And that's the case that DeSantis has made. Representative Matt Gaetz, who's campaigning with DeSantis, has also made it. So I think this is going to be a little bit different than some other races where Trump has weighed in and couldn't get it done, because, you know, Ron DeSantis is not Luther Strange. You know, Ron DeSantis is a smart, tough politician. He's turning into classwork. Putnam saying Putnam had everything handed to him while DeSantis was defending the country in Iraq. There's going to be a lot of contrast, and Trump is going to be able to demagogue off it. And Florida voters, especially the 65 and over set, are very susceptible to demagoguery. So this is going to be a favorable play for the pro-Trump people.
That's a demographic twist Florida has that maybe some other states might not have to the same degree.
Yeah, I was at a DeSantis rally over the weekend, and I saw a lot of people over 65, and they were grunting in agreement with the things that are being said, especially more radical things. These guys want red meat, and they wanted it yesterday.
Yeah. What were some of the radical things that were said?
Well, basically, you know, when Putnam was being condemned from the stage, that was something somebody would grunt at, you know, those kind of things. I was like, there's like a guy standing behind me who's grunting, and it's like the more radical the rhetoric was, the more he was agreeing. And I think that is the voter they are trying to churn out. They're trying to, you know, push that button and get those people engaged.
Okay, so that's the primary strategy, certainly. What about the general election? It's months away. But as we see this increasingly angry and divisive rhetoric over the immigration crisis, and now we're seeing, for example, Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi was heckled at a movie theater in Tampa when she went to go see the Mr. Rogers documentary. Okay. The White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders was not served at a restaurant in Virginia because the owner felt that she's supporting a cruel and corrupt and inhumane administration. Here's an email from Marilyn in Palm Coast. You know that old expression, when they go low, we go high? Guess what? It doesn't work that way anymore. Pushback is happening everywhere because we all know that dear leader, and she puts that in quotes, referring, I guess, to the president, gets away with it and his polls go up. So I have to tell you, coming into work today, as I watched all this play out over the weekend, I was more unsettled than I think I've ever been in covering these things. Covering politics in this state and in this country, this is not a good place that the country is at right now.
Yeah, no, I would have to agree with that, Melissa. This is a very, very splintered and fractured country. I don't think that you can really overstate that. There's a zealousness to both sides. I mean, I think when AG was talking about the fervor on the Republican side, you answer your listener's email, there's also a fervor on the liberal side, the progressive side. And I think the entire thing of or concept of when they go low, we'll go high, I think liberals have realized when they go high, they lose. And that's just the reality of the politics. And I think that you're going to see a lot of bare knuckles moving towards the fall. As to the gubernatorial race, I think that what you're going to see is because of the fact that Gillum and Levine and Chris King have taken who was, assumed to be the favorite at the beginning with Gwen Graham and pushed her to the left. And of course, in DeSantis and Putnam are going to be so far on the right, I think you're going to see a mad race to the center with whoever is going to end up coming back because we are so polarized. You're going to see that the Republican vote will be locked in, the Democratic vote will be locked in, and then this mystery 8-10% of the general public who is undecided, you're going to see that competition for them really ramp up. And I think you will see a lot of the rhetoric you're going to see with DeSantis and Putnam, I think will calm down because they realize they're going to have to speak to a more broad electorate.
Let's go to your calls now as we're talking politics on this Monday morning with A.G. Gankarski and Daniel Cronrath. So much has happened in just the last couple of days. We're trying to keep up with it all as we welcome you into the conversation at 549-2937. Ira is on the South Side. Hi, Ira. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm an Army Airborne retired. I'd like somebody to hold DeSantis accountable for the stolen valor that he articulates, that he's a combat veteran. He's not. He was a JAG officer in country supporting rules of engagement. He never engaged the enemy. He never got shot at. So I wish he'd quit characterizing himself as a combat veteran. I'd appreciate if one of your reporters could take care of that. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for that. A.G. Gankarski.
I don't think Putnam is the guy to make that stolen valor case because, you know, Putnam hasn't served and DeSantis has already said that. And I don't know who on the Democratic side can really make that case either. You know, any of the four, you know, five if you count Jeff Green, any of those candidates, I don't think they have a history of military service. So that's going to be one that's going to be made by a third-party group. That's going to have to be one that's going to be met on the slant. I don't think it's going to become a direct issue in the campaign. And for many voters, I think that's a distinction without a difference at this point. We're past the point of drafts and everything.
Daniel.
Yeah, I would agree with AG on that. This is really the territory you would expect a third-party group to come in, somebody who was aligned with Commissioner Putnam, but somebody that the commissioner could be insulated from, somebody who would be able to, well, in reality, be similar to the Swift boating attacks, which occurred on John Kerry in 2004, except maybe with, as the caller suggests, with some actual merit to them. But, you know, really where you would have a group of similar veterans who may form a third-party group and then challenge the
We are seeing third-party ads flutter airwaves. Let's talk about a couple of them.
Yeah, let's do that. Obviously, the most interesting third-party actions in the governor's race, there's a group, the Collective Pack, I believe, that you know is acting on behalf of Gillum that has really submarined Gwen Graham in a couple places. That was nasty. But right now, the winner going away to National Liberty Federation. It's a sugar front, you know, big sugar. And they are working on behalf of Putnam against DeSantis. They got him on missing immigration, you know, missing a bunch of votes and, you know, making a vote for allegedly for amnesty. That's a contention that DeSantis counters. But that ad is it's already high six figures. They're just going to keep running it. There's no shortage of money for that.
549-2937. Give us a call. Ed is along 295. Hi, Ed.
Yes, hi. Just want to make a point here. We keep talking about the immigrants, mixing the those who are like myself and many others in the city who can hear legally through either normal immigration or refugee programs, asylum programs, and the illegals or undocumented. Please don't mix them up. They're totally different. We went through the process. We waited. We pay a lot of money to go through all the expenses that you need to come to this great country. We got all the shots, all the physical, medical physicals. And
where'd you come from, Ed?
We came here later.
Ed, what country did you come from?
Cuba.
Cuba.
I came from Cuba. And they had yesterday, I believe, a caller Friday from Colombia. You know, there's a big problem. Don't mix us up. There's a difference. You call them alien or undocumented, but don't say immigrant because you can be pro-immigrant immigration like most people tend to be and not in favor of unlimited undocumented or aliens coming over. We cannot afford it. It's just a fact.
And
by the way, being poor and being from a high crime is not a reason to be allowed to come here.
Ed, have you read the accounts, though, of why the majority of the people are coming here, particularly from countries like Guatemala and Honduras? You know, the majority of these people are coming because they fear for they and their children's safety.
Okay,
how is
absolutely.
That any different than someone seeking asylum at a designated port of entry? If you're in a desperate situation, you know, what would you do if you were in that situation?
Sure. Oh, number one, I don't blame anybody who wanted to come here from the entire planet. That's why people tend to come here, and Americans who don't leave to move out. But I can assure you, if you're a poor American from Chicago or Detroit, from a high crime area, and you were to jump into any country in Latin America or the Caribbean and come in and say, I have no money, I'm poor, and I come from a high crime area, they're going to take you right. They're not going to allow you to stay if you sneak in. That's the problem.
I realize
problem
that, but I honestly, I don't think the issue is I think most people of good faith agree that if you cross the border illegally, you've broken the law. It's a misdemeanor on first entry. It's a felony on repeated entries. But I think the furor is less over that and really rather more over the fact that children have been forcibly separated from their parents, which is simply a cruel and inhumane policy and one that every human rights group in the world has condemned. And so for me anyway, the issue is more about the fate of these kids who some of whom may suffer permanent separation from their parents and that is being done now that they're trying to make efforts to reunite some of these kids. But it's simply a fact, I think, Daniel and AG, that some of these kids may never see their parents again and they will be punished per government policy for the poor decision, which certainly a lot of people would agree with you that their parents might have made a poor decision. But we've never before punished children in an official capacity in this way for the decisions that their parents made. And so I think the reason the country is in such an uproar is because the way these kids are being treated is unprecedented in this country as policy, and that many children at the same time. Do you understand where I'm going with that?
Isn't that being corrected now? Because it started with the Obama administration who did it. In fact,
the unaccompanied minor crisis of 2014 is not at all the same. Right. It is not at all the same, although it was a crisis and it was wrong. But it is not the same as separating young children and toddlers and even babies from their parents. It's simply not the same. All right. Thanks for the call, Ed. Go ahead, Daniel.
Yeah, I think to that last point, there is a matter of scale here that we have to look at relative to and intent. I think Ed makes a really, really good point here. And I think there is a public education aspect to this that we're still missing as a society. People come to this country or seek safety in this country in a variety of different ways. And we need to make sure that these children we're talking about, these are not people trying to bring their children illegally across the Rio Grande River. These are individuals who are coming to the designated port of entry, seeking refuge in the United States, whether it's political asylum, whether it is just to get out of these bad situations. So they are here and they are doing the right thing as defined by U.S. law. I think the other thing, too, that I would ask Ed, I mean, throughout the history of the United States, we have had over the last several hundred years, people who have come to the United States from other places for the exact same reasons that the caller said were not reasons to come to the United States, quite frankly. If you fear that you're living in a bad situation, that you are impoverished, that you can't find work, and that your safety is at risk from gangs or whatever, that's exactly why people come to the United States. And as long as they do that legally, I think that we need to really, really be aware of the fact that when we have a president of the United States saying we are going to deny people due process – who are doing the right thing, because the president was not specific. He just was carte blanche in terms of how he was going to apply this policy. Again, in my mind, I mean, there's really no other word for that than just immoral. It's the wrong way, and it's the wrong way to execute policy.
Yeah, it's an extension of many years on the part of the American government. Many years of basically treating Latin America with casual disregard or hostility. Think of all these countries, Mexico, Central America. In what country has America not played a role in fomenting, the crisis? The Mexican drug war, that's our fault. The governments in Central America, that's our fault. We played a hand in these governments over the course of decades. Another thing to factor in that isn't getting mentioned enough, the role of private industry in warehousing these children, private prison operators, analogous type operators basically are running the business. We have one here in Florida that Governor Rick Scott gave financial incentives to. We're looking at this and we're horrified by what the president said, but what the president said, or tweeted rather, is really an extension of what we've been doing for 40 years. He's putting in fifth gear, pushing the gas pedal and saying, well, let's get rid of due process, close the trial balloon. And there is a lot of support for that because we have moved away, especially since 9/11, from constitutional mores, and this is the payoff.
And let me just clarify, when Ed called a minute ago the caller and said Obama did it too, there was a crisis over unaccompanied minors at the border in 2014, and the Obama administration was roundly criticized and its feet were held to the fire for it. However, that involved children coming across alone. That administration and the Bush administration, by and large, did not routinely separate children from their parents. And I just want to clarify that.
Right. And I think the other thing too, Melissa, if you look at where we've changed in terms of our political landscape, particularly on the Republican side in 20 years, George Bush and Karl Rove designed a strategy for social policy where they literally say we will punish the parents and love the children. Within 20 years, now we seem to be, or some aspects of the Republican Party seem to be okay if you look at the public polling with what the president actually did. I mean, really, to even have 30% of the American public say we agree with the steps taken, obviously it's a majority who didn't, but to have 30% of the American people basically say, yeah, there's cause here for separating a parent from a child from their parent is really alarming.
And how about the fact that do you agree or not, either one of you, with the notion that it's a slippery slope for the president to call for the suspension of due process? Where does that lead?
This
is the president, all presidents swear to uphold and defend the Constitution. Due process is a cornerstone of our democracy.
Yes, but many find reasons to to fall short of them. FDR did it with Japanese immigrants.
Which is why we're seeing comparisons to Japanese internment today.
Right. And, you know, even, you know, the Bush administration post 9/11, you look at something like Gitmo. You've got people at Gitmo who've been there for two decades who have never had a trial, never had due process. They're just being warehoused there. This is on a different scale. Donald Trump does things a bit differently. He's willing to get on Twitter and use this kind of rhetoric to sell the policy and push it to the extreme. President Obama, there wasn't the same type of scrutiny on what he did because President Obama had the sense not to advocate authoritarian solutions to problems. So this is kind of a perfect storm, a convergence of an aging, base that, is really grievance driven. And that combined with the president that's willing to play to them.
I would say this, Melissa, these issues have been with us since the beginning of our country. If you look at one of our most esteemed founding fathers, Benjamin Franklin, who was very, very outspoken in the fact that German immigrants in his mind were going to destroy the American colonies because they were stupid. So I think the question becomes in 2018.
No Irish need apply.
Yeah, well, yeah.
My great-great-great-grandfather saw that sign. Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. Well, no, I think that there still remains. I think the thing which is difficult for us to see in 2018 is that there are still strong elements of tribalism in the United States. And I think the AG's point, too, and this is going back, which is something which was made earlier, when you look at who is typically talking to these Republican voters, the average age of the Fox News viewership is 68 years old. And so when AG talks about these individuals who are being whipped up at these rallies, that's exactly who that audience is on a daily basis. They're hearing this message coming from that media source.
Steve is in Arlington. Hi, Steve. You're on the air. Good morning. Hey, Steve.
Morning.
Go ahead.
The reason I was calling is my wife is actually from South America, and her family came in through Canada and also through New York, and they literally came in piece by piece. So until they were able to afford to bring the children in, they didn't bring them in. And so I think there's a way to do this, and I certainly reflect the other side, which is we do need to take care of the kids. They can be a victim here and just kind of a fallout instead of being protected. So there's a balance there. And it is a hard subject in that respect. That's my comment. I'll jump off the line and let you respond to that.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for that.
Yeah, I think the caller makes a good point. And I think what you're going to see over the long term with this policy is you're going to see a moderation of it. It's going to be driven, by necessity. It's going to be driven by, coverage. We are really evolving toward a new normal in terms of marginalized groups in this country. New normal where, rights are not considered universal, where there's not due process for all. And, we are in a point where we're theoretically, at least, in economic prosperity. Unemployment is low. Housing values continue to go up. All of these governmental metrics of a strong economy. What happens when the economy collapses? What happens when you have no longer any blockage from government statistics for class warfare. Just buckle up. We're seeing a change in the American system. I don't know how it changes back.
And I think that's so disturbing to so many Americans that's why we're seeing these increasingly ugly and stern clashes between the parties. You're seeing members of Congress on the Democratic side saying, keep up the public shaming of the Trump administration officials. Here's a tweet from Chris. I have the unpopular opinion of being against that tactic of not serving someone based on any reason. You cannot engage people without inclusion. And so, those that are calling for moderation, reason, toning down this rhetoric, I applaud that. At the same time, what's so disturbing to me as I've watched this play out is that we're seeing the development of two hostile warring camps and tribalism higher than I can honestly ever remember it in my lifetime. And it's not good. This is not a good place for this country. to be in.
And I think the thing that we need to remember here, too, is that every single time in the last year and a half that it looks like, or 2 years, that we think that this issue is going to relax, the president of the United States himself, you know, starts it again. He is the one who pours kerosene onto the fire, so to speak. And I think a big reason for that is this, in my mind, has been a slow but a steady breakdown of the Republican coalition. And I think that when you have you know, a lot of individuals on the Republican side, we know that the demographics of this country are changing, that the one way that they can retain power is to really go after culture war issues, which is what we're seeing take place in the United States. And the president has been very expert in doing that. He has been able to find a way to really, you know, continue kind of a level of cognitive dissonance. If you really think about the typical Republican voter and their, a lot of their income levels and things, you would think that they would be favoring Democratic strategies or Democratic policies, but they're not. They're you know, really, really going after these culture war issues that the president is able to push their button, so to speak, and you know, really get their support.
Jennifer on the South Side emails the show, I want to respond to AG's comments that we are seeing a new normal. What we are seeing is not normal, and I refuse to accept this as the new normal. Hashtag resist.
Yeah, I mean, that works to a point, but I mean, consider we have pretty gerrymandered elections. In the two elections that most of the people in our listening area can vote in, you got John Rutherford, who's going up against a completely overmatched Democrat. And in District 5, where you could theoretically see a liberal person, you've got two conservative Democrats, Alvin Brown and Al Lawson. You know, they will offer something in a way of resistance, but in terms of hashtag resist, I don't think either of them really embody that. So, you know, you can rhetorically oppose it. I rhetorically oppose it. But, you know, I look at the political landscape and I see a different conclusion being drawn, which is, you know, it's like the old poem, you know, the best lacked all conviction, the worst are full of passionate intensity or murderous intensity. And that's what this reminds me of.
And so, and you cover these local and regional and statewide races at a really deep, granular level. This listener is talking about, I think, going even beyond the local politics, what's happening in the country as a whole. And it was what I was getting back to, which is on the left, people are increasingly saying, we're going to throw sand in the gears of what we see happening because we feel as though this is not reflective of our American values. And as you pointed out on the right, Daniel, people are just living in a completely different political world. They're saying we are okay with these policies because they do reflect our values. How can we remain a country with two completely opposed sets of values? And no, it's as though America is a piece of taffy. And, you know, when you take it and you pull it apart and there are two big blobs on either end and this tiny little string in the middle, just barely connecting the two huge blobs on either end. I for some reason, I can't get that image out of my mind. I'm worried that at some point that string is going to break.
Yeah, it's a really, really good illustration, Melissa. I like to view it more as a kind of the classic two steps forward and one step back. I think that with the election of President Obama, we took a huge cultural step forward in the United States, and now you're seeing the inevitable backlash to that from some segments of society. But I think to the writer and then to AG's point, I think this fall is going to offer the referendum on this new normal. I think whatever the voters tend to do this fall, if there is in fact a blue wave, what message is sent? Will this passion and fervor actually show up at the polls? We know that a lot of this energy in the millennial age bracket, millennials do not tend to vote with the same frequency as individuals who are over the age of 65. Will they? Will the American people say that this new normal or this that basically the era of Trump is not what they want to see become the new, you know, the new normal in American politics?
We always welcome both your thoughts, and thanks for coming by, and hope you come back soon. Thanks for being here, A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics, Daniel Cronrath of FSCJ. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Melissa.
And later, Cole Pepper on the World Cup, local sports. That's coming up later. But up next, it's First Coast Success today as we profile one of the top legal eagles in town, star criminal defense attorney Hank Cox. That's after this. We'll be right back.
WJCT and Baptist Health are pleased to announce that Bobby Thomas, beauty and fashion expert and author of The Power of Style, Everything You Need to Know Before You Get Dressed, will be this year's keynote speaker at A Day for Her, Saturday, August 18th at the Hyatt Hotel. Bobby, the style editor for The Today Show, will share Bobby's buzz tips on everything from favorite beauty tricks to her favorite lifestyle finds. For more information or to purchase tickets, log on to wjct.org/events.
On the next Radio Lab.
We're talking about objects, I believe.
Yeah.
Wonderful things.
Objects brimming with meaning.
It was on the moon?
Absolutely.
This was on the moon.
Yes.
This was on the moon.
Very cool. Very interesting.
And with their own impermanence.
Let's hide it.
We know it's going to disappear.
Oh, no, no.
We know it won't last.
I know it was here.
That's enough, you guys. Leave it alone.
Things.
That's on the next Radio Lab.
Sunday at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Hi, I'm Andrew Wickman, host of Blues Horizon. The best in classic and modern blues is now on twice a week. Blues Horizon, Monday and Wednesday nights at 11, right here on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Well, he's one of the best-known attorneys in Jacksonville. Hank Cox is known as a lawyer to the stars, but he's also represented high-profile clients in big cases like the one involving Christian Fernandez, the young kid who for a while was on trial for murder and eventually moved to juvenile detention. Cox is seen as one of the top criminal defense lawyers in the region, if not the country. And he's also the only person to be both head of the local bar association and the Florida bar. In this month's First Coast Success, Karen Bruni Mathis of the Daily Record sat down with Hank Cox to talk about his life and career.
Hank Cox is a director at the Bedell Firm. He's known for a lot. For his time as a prosecutor, as a defense lawyer to the local stars and to young Christian Fernandez, as Mary Cox's husband and Katie, Mattson, and Ann's father, as a cancer survivor, and as a man with insight and one who is unafraid to wield his wit. Hank Cox, welcome to First Coast Success.
Thank you, Karen.
You've been practicing law for how long now?
We can leave it as quite a while. I've been around.
Did you want to be a lawyer when you grew up?
It never dawned on me being a lawyer as I grew up. As a matter of fact, and this is true, when I was finishing college, it didn't dawn on me on being a lawyer. I went to law school with a number of friends out of college who were all waiting to be drafted to go to Southeast Asia. Some with the lottery being instituted the first year of law school, some went, some didn't. I had a draft notice to report to Newark, New Jersey, and because of the number in the lottery, it was canceled 2 weeks before I was inducted. So.
What was that number?
363.
That was some evening when you watched those numbers pulled.
Oh, it was. I think it was true throughout the country. I was with about 30 people. To be candid, there were kegs of beer because it was a huge event for a number of people's lives, And you could have heard a pin drop every time they called a number. And if someone got a low number, you get totally quiet and solemn. Nobody said a word. Nobody said a word the whole evening.
What took you to law school then?
Well, that's what took me to law school. I figured I might as well start with the rest of my friends. We all went to different law schools. I went to one in Washington and Lee in Virginia. Two went to Florida. Two went to Notre Dame. But in any event, we all assumed we were going to get drafted. So we assumed it was a meaningless exercise or we'd come back later and finish it then, which is what many did. I stayed on through. So I did not plan to be a lawyer when I started law school. It was literally just something to do.
Why did you do it then? You started, talk about your career. Where did you start?
Well, I didn't, in law school, and this probably had some bearing in the later years, I had three jobs during law school to help pay for it. And then a summer job, I'll tell you about. In law school, I managed a Humane Society shelter on the weekends. In the springtime, I helped prepare tax returns for farmers, and then three nights a week worked the shift from 11 at night till 7 in the morning at the local motel, because I had to make money to pay for the school. So, and the summer, In the summer, it was a break of a lifetime for someone my age through college and law school. I shipped out on merchant ships out of a Union Hall in Brooklyn, New York, around, you know, across the Atlantic, Caribbean, all that stuff. So
you've had quite the experiences.
Well, you get used to working, that's for sure.
So, you're known as a workaholic.
Probably to a great many people, the people I work with, my family. Eddie Booth told me years ago before he passed away that when you have the children, don't lose time. Don't let it catch up with you, and then you find out you didn't spend the time you should have. And that probably does apply to me. I think if I could recapture some time, it would be with the children and not work.
Do you have grandchildren?
I do. I have two grandsons here in Jacksonville, a granddaughter in Washington, and a grandson in Washington.
You probably spend time with them.
I do every chance you can, and I will say that when you introduced the family, in case he listens to it, you said Madison. His name is actually Mattson.
Mattson.
Which is my middle name. So
great, okay.
Just for his benefit, I said that, not mine.
Oh, I'm glad. let's talk about your career. You're a defense lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
You were a prosecutor. Why did you move into the defense side?
I did it after prosecuting for about 7 years. An attorney in town named Warren Anderson, whom people know, Sierra Club and other environmental issues that he's active in. We decided it was just time to try something different. Ed Austin had been great to me. I'd been his first assistant. He was the one who engineered getting me a job in the first place when he was general counsel by talking to Harry Shorstein, who hired me. Warren and I decided we'd try something different. And you have the advantage if you prosecuted. You're familiar with the courtroom. You're familiar with the judges. You're familiar with talking to jurors. So it's not a great transition. And it isn't, to me, a philosophical transition. Our system of justice says that you have two sides to the justice system. One prosecutes, one defends, and you've got rules to play by. So everybody plays by the rules.
Well, you're known for your ability to get the job done. What's your strategy? Do you have any secrets you can share?
I don't know if there are any secrets. I have, well, you are influenced by other people when you're younger and when you start out doing things. And I use Ed Austin and Major Harding and Eddie Booth as three examples where they train you to listen instead of talk. And the more you listen, the more you learn. The more you learn, the more effective I think people can become. Never been interested in other people telling me how good they are. Never been interested in other people telling me how much they know. I can make that judgment myself. I just listen. I find myself usually listening. Probably as I get older, I do less listening. But.
What do you consider your biggest success?
I'm not sure how you would define success. If it were objective, I don't know if it's biggest. I would include things like being invited to do a TED Talk, that someone thought you had the skill or the talent or the ability to do it.
Mother Laura Adorkor Kofi was a leader of the Black Nationalist Movement before she was assassinated in Miami in 1928. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll discuss the woman who is still regarded by some as a divine prophet. We'll talk about topographical maps and auto racing in Daytona. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Sumner Redstone, he of Viacom and CBS, has said for years he is never going to die.
He would proudly say that, kind of as a joke, to reporters for years. I'm never going to die. I'm going to control this even from beyond the grave. I don't have to do any succession planning because I'm never going to die. Ha ha.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Redstone is still around, so the joke's on who? The media empire he built and how. Next time on Marketplace.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, the ongoing crisis with contaminated water and lead poisoning in Flint, Michigan. Terry Gross talks with pediatrician and public health advocate Mona Hannah Atisha about the research that led her to sound the alarm back in 2015. Nearly 3 years later, she still doesn't drink tap water there. She's now the director of an initiative to deal with the crisis. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Comedian Patton Oswalt says just being funny is not enough anymore.
Right now, we're in a time where kindness to a lot of people seems cruel or seems like an attack or seems weak.
Oswalt uses comedy to interrogate the times in which we live, to help us face life's challenges, and, of course, to make us laugh. Patton Oswalt, next time on 1A.
Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, at the midway point of the World Cup, there are still more than a handful of teams who could win it all.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
And Culpepper says, without the U.S. playing, soccer fans in this country are rooting for other nations. Good morning.
Well, good morning. Yeah, you have to pick somebody to root for, I think, in the World Cup, even if it's just a passing fancy. Maybe you visited Costa Rica once and you vote for Costa Rica or what have you. I will say that with all the fans picking somebody to root for, it has created some interesting conversations in the soccer community. There's been a certain amount of controversy that some former U.S. men's national team players like Landon Donovan and Alexi Lalas have been rooting for Mexico, perhaps in Lalas's case, working for Fox, wanting to get that better rating number for Fox, who has the World Cup. However, I think in some regards, a U.S. fan rooting for Mexico is kind of like a Florida fan rooting for Florida State if the Gators wouldn't make the college football playoffs. I'm not saying it's ridiculous. I'm just saying these fans have a different definition of a rivalry than I do. The U.S. and Mexico, obviously huge rivals in soccer. I've been rooting for England. I've decided to let bygones be bygones and not begrudge them for trying to rob us of our independence in 1776.
You're just going
to
let that go.
I'm going to let it go finally now. Or as my English friends say, the downsizing of the colonies.
The downsizing.
Yeah, which I think worked out well for everybody, probably. Yesterday, England turned in a dominating performance in a 6-2 win. Harry Kane, the Tottenham Hotspur striker, scored a hat trick, a rare feat in the World Cup. That will make him a legend. The last goal, however, I will say, a little bit incidental, maybe just a sign of good living, on a ball that was hit by a teammate. It glanced off his heel and went in. So, hey, you'll take it. It's a goal.
Yeah, it's still a goal.
And it's a hat trick. A couple of the other teams that have impressed me so far, Portugal with Cristiano Ronaldo. Brazil has looked very good. Mexico has looked extremely good. Belgium looks like they're very good on the attack. And maybe a wild card team coming out of Africa, Nigeria, has had their moments. We'll see how it all plays out. They're getting closer and closer to the round of 16 when it really gets pared down. One other note here, Melissa, on the World Cup. When the United States, Mexico, and Canada host the World Cup in 8 years, there will be more teams involved then. There'll be, instead of 32, there will be 48 teams. So, of course, the U.S. will get in automatically as a host country. But to see what happens between now and then in terms of the way that some of these matches are played, we've had some blowout matches early on. We may see more of those as the field expands in 8 years. Speaking of soccer, the Armada are heading into the home stretch before the playoffs in good position to make the postseason. Despite a 0-0 draw Saturday, the Armada still positioned to make the postseason. Jacksonville is hosting the only team to beat them this year, Palm Beach United, Wednesday at UNF.
Very nice. That'll be a fun game. Hopefully not too blazingly hot.
Yeah, it'll be 7:30 kickoff. Still going to be fairly warm. And I can tell you, in the match on Saturday, the heat was certainly a factor. You could just see the fatigue resting in. And the Armada are in a stretch here where they're playing a lot of games back-to-back, like a Saturday-Wednesday or a Sunday-Wednesday kind of turnaround. So the legs can be a factor for everyone.
Yeah. Which is why I like going to see Sharks games in
air conditioning
arena football.
And they won their record or their franchise mark 100th game in franchise history on Saturday, beating the Maine Mammoths 51-21. Sharks are also in position to make the postseason with 5 weeks to play in the NAL schedule.
Yeah, so go out and see them this summer. And last but not least, speaking of football, Cole says Jaguars training camp just around the corner.
31 days away from training camp. This past week, two Jaguars players, Jalen Ramsey and Calais Campbell, were announced as being among the top 20 in the NFL on the top 100 list that comes each and every year. This is a vote from other players around the league. So you're talking about guys who certainly have great reputations among their peers. And with those two, A.J. Boye, Yannick Ngakoue, this is a team that's starting to pick up. Leonard Fournette was on the top 100 list. So you're talking about a team, a roster that I think is the strongest roster the Jaguars have ever had coming into this season. They added Andrew Norwell, who was first-team All-Pro as a guard. You've got rising stars like Miles Jack coming into their own. Cam Robinson, a left tackle, who wasn't down. There's beer to prove it.
That's beer to prove it.
And to see where this roster is right now heading into training camp, it tells me and has told a lot of other reporters around the league that this is a Jaguars team that has the horses to win the race. They have the mentality. Now all they have to do is put it all together and stay healthy. If they do that, this is a Super Bowl contender. There's no doubt in my mind. This is a Super Bowl contending team. So it starts in 31 days when training camp, the first practice of training camp, convenes across the street here at...
And how much can fans take in and watch of that, by the way?
That's still to be determined. There is going to be some fan viewing of that. This offseason with the organized team activities in minicamp, there was no fan viewing allowed, but in training camp there will be plenty. And those dates are being parsed out right now as we speak.
All right. We'll look for those. Always good to see you, Cole, and follow Cole on Twitter at Cole Pepper for all your sports news. Catch him on TV every night, too, on Channel 4, WJXT.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you. And that's our show. That's it for today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs the board, and our show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. 1A's up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. If you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight, just keep listening for the Electro Lounge. Have a great day, everybody.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.